Welcome to the John Oakley Show podcast. On today's episode...
Why are we tolerating this culture of mediocrity?
I continue to be puzzled.
That guy sucks.
Vote for me and life will suck.
They might be entertaining and charismatic in the short term. It's a recipe for disaster in the long term.
It's a great day for a podcast. Once again, here he is, John Oakley.
Great afternoon for Talk Radio. The culture of mediocrity seems like it's epidemic, and we settle for less than competent individuals. You might call them underwhelming. And why is that? Where competence is in short supply. I've often wondered about it, but now we've got somebody who's crystallized this in the Harvard Business Review, the author of Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders, psychologist Dr. Thomas Chamorro Premusic. Dr. Premusic, good afternoon and welcome to the Oakley Show in Toronto.
It's good to be here. Hi.
I appreciate you joining us because I've often wondered about this, why we seemingly have devolved when it comes to competence with our leadership. Any idea why that would be?
Of course. The main issue at stake is that as the world becomes more and more complex, and it's harder and harder to judge whether people have the critical qualities or attributes that you need them to have, for example, to occupy positions of leadership or influence, things like curiosity, critical thinking, integrity, humility, the more we end up relying on our gut feel, on our intuition, on our instincts. And when you rely on your instincts and you look at somebody and you want to decide whether you would like to have a beer with that person or whether they look competent, actually you guide yourself by their confidence. And one of the most striking findings in our research and my colleagues' research is that the best way to come across as confident to others is to actually self-deceive and delude yourself into thinking that you're amazing when in fact you're not, which ends up explaining why so many narcissistic, overconfident, and undercompetent people rise to the top.
Wow, it's almost like the old saying, BS baffles brains.
Indeed.
Folks who present themselves as overcompetent or overconfident are perhaps lacking in competence. That's what's being masked here?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's fair enough to blame the people that get there because then they're not just accountable, but responsible for the well-being and the success of groups, organizations, and societies at large. But we should also demand more maturity from followers. I think we need to be able to look at a leader who says, I don't know what the answer is, but my self-doubt is actually a sign of rationality. It means I'm less likely to be deluded and to BS myself. And instead, we gravitate towards people who seem really dominant, very assertive, very masculine at times. And unfortunately, despite the fact that they might be entertaining and charismatic in the short term, it's a recipe for disaster in the long term.
So you say manifestations of hubris, often masked as charisma or charm, are commonly mistaken for leadership potential. And these occur more frequently in men than in women. Explain that disparity.
Well, there is a universal gender difference in confidence, whereby, you know, I mean, it's more pronounced in places like Argentina, Brazil, Japan, and the US than in places like Iceland or Scandinavia. But in general, if you assess somebody's actual skill or ability in any domain of knowledge or expertise, and then you ask them to rate themselves on that domain, you find a very, very prevalent universal pattern, which is that women are much more likely to self-assess accurately and to have an insight into what their abilities are and what their limitations are, whereas men gravitate towards the hubristic end of the pole. So in essence, they are not just less aware of their limitations, but also unjustifiably pleased with themselves. And ironically, you know, this should be a disadvantage. I mean, we shouldn't, you know, gravitate towards, I don't know, following leaders who say, follow me, I'm your hero. And then when they tell us to cross the road, we're going to be hit by a truck or a train. We should actually follow people who say, be careful, take it easy. This is a complicated situation and we'll work out the solution together. But when people, whether they're male or female, demonstrate any capacity or capability for self-awareness, we label them insecure. We accuse them of having imposter syndrome. And instead, we go and romanticize with this idea that if a leader seems tough, they're a good leader.
So basically, you're saying women may tend to be better leaders.
That is correct. And actually, I've written about this extensively. And as I always say, the best gender diversity intervention would be to focus on talent, not on gender. Because if you treat leadership selection or election, if you want, as a sort of like blind tasting wine exercise, and you ignore people's gender, but you focus on the qualities that make people better leaders, things like humility, emotional intelligence, self-awareness, self-control, integrity, people skills, and EQ, you would probably end up with 60 to 65% of leaders being female and only 35 to 40% of leaders being male. So the irony would be that we would need affirmative action and positive discrimination to help more men get to the top, because in a talent-centric world, we would have not just more women in charge, but also more competent leaders.
Let me ask you then finally, you say this is a pathological system that rewards men for their incompetence while punishing women for their competence. Is this bias evolutionary?
It's a really good question. And I would say mostly it isn't. You know, throughout a great deal of time in our evolutionary history, if you look back, you know, to our early years in when we were living in hunter-gatherer groups, etc., groups were very egalitarian. Leaders were chosen on the basis of their knowledge, their expertise, their ability to look after their teams. And actually, leadership selection was more or less 50-50. At some point, and probably, you know, throughout most of the medieval years, and that's also true in the 18th century, in the 19th century, leadership became very aggressive. It was about being who's the most violent, ruthless person. And then this despotic, tyrannic view of leaders as somebody who is, in essence, a strong man, actually became more perversive. But culture has the ability to change these trends. And I think it's important to acknowledge that not only is it the case that women today could add a lot of these qualities, be it empathy, kindness, consideration, emotional intelligence, humility, that are needed in leaders. But actually, there are many men who display these qualities and who have potential for these qualities. And paradoxically, they're overlooked for leadership roles because they don't resemble the macho-like leader profile.
So we have to reassess the paradigm then and select accordingly based on competence rather than charisma or other sort of misleading traits. Very, very insightful. Doctor, I really appreciate your time this afternoon and giving us an overview.
Thank you. Anytime. Thank you very much for having me.
You got it. Dr. Thomas Chamorro Permusic, psychologist and author of Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? On the other side, going to talk to a criminologist with Loyola University in Chicago. He's co-authored studies about the efficacy of Crime Stoppers. So to the point, be on the lookout. And there's $1 million in total prize money for 25 of Canada's most wanted, the bulk of whom, our guests, are from the Toronto area. So he'll tell us just how this might actually result in apprehensions or not. Moments away on The Oakley Show, 640 Toronto.
Look, anybody who's ever been a criminal, like I was, knows that there's one dude you absolutely do not play with. That's this man right here.
John Oakley.
Great afternoon for Talk Radio. Let's talk about Crime Stoppers, because that's what the BOLO initiative here announced by Chief Demkew and others. Be on the lookout for the worst people in Canada. 25 on the most wanted list. And there's $1 million in total. About $100,000 for the most notorious and wanted, and then $50,000 per individual somewhere further down the list. But let's find out about it. Arthur Lorigio is a criminologist with Loyola University in Chicago and has co-authored studies about the efficacy of Crime Stoppers, and he's joined us here on The Oakley Show this afternoon. Arthur, I appreciate you joining us. Good afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be with you.
All right, so we got this newly announced program, Be on the Lookout, and $1 million in total for rewards for 25 individuals being sought. In general, are these rewards programs like this, you know, through anonymous tip lines, et cetera, Crime Stoppers probably being most prominent, are they successful?
It depends on how you define successful. Crime Stoppers programs have been around since 1976. They started in Albuquerque, New Mexico, spread with mushroom-like growth across the United States for 15 or 20 years and into Canada. The programs are interesting collaboration between law enforcement, the media, and donors. That's the citizen contribution. They're usually business persons who would contribute money toward the reward dollars. The programs have always focused on cold cases, cases that have been unsolved, and those with demonstrable effort having already been made, exhausted all of the investigative tools available. And so now we're reaching out to the public, doing reenactments of the crime, which was the key that has never been done before Crime Stoppers in the way it was been done. And it rose to great national and international prominence with John Walsh's programming, which was responsible for solving thousands of cases, among them some of the most notorious criminals in history in the United States. So success can be measured on number of crimes solved, and the numbers are quite formidable. Success can be measured on taking dangerous criminals off the street, meaning criminals who have been committing heinous crimes or repeated violent crimes of a lower level. That's successful. The question that's never been answered to the extent that the answer would have scientific validity is whether these cases would have been solved otherwise had significant additional resources being invested in solving them. Well, so we don't know if we isolate the effects of Crime Stoppers, whether that's what made a difference, or be on the lookout. If there wasn't a be on the lookout, would these cases have been solved otherwise if they would be given the same degree of resources?
Meaning the $1 million, if they had earmarked that for, say, greater investigative resources, that's the question mark, whether these perps would have been caught. Is that right?
Yes, I like what you said about greater investigative resources. If you're also talking about the amount of the reward, my research showed that there's a point of diminishing returns, that increasing the amount of award dollars did not make a difference after a certain ceiling threshold. And making a difference meant, would the people who have been reporting crimes call again if they were offered a lesser reward? And the people who call in general, I don't know if that's going to be the case with Be on the Lookout, were people who were engaged in crimes themselves or part of the what we call the fringe of the criminal element in any of the cities, because they would be privy to information about crimes that have been committed. Whereas the everyday citizen who's keeping his or her nose clean, who's not engaged in criminal activity, won't be privy to the burglaries and the robberies that have been committed because they're not part of the criminal social network.
So again, Arthur Lorigio is a criminologist with Loyola University in Chicago. He's co-authored studies about the efficacy of Crime Stoppers. We're talking about this rewards program that was unveiled by the police earlier today, $1 million in total for the 25 most wanted across the country. And so the top in the echelon get $100,000 assigned to them. And by the way, that 100,000 figure, and then at a lower tier, somewhere in the middle of the 25 pack, 50,000 per individual. Mm-hmm. You talked about the amounts, and maybe there's not much to distinguish, you know, 100,000 versus 50,000. Mm-hmm. What does your research tell you in that regard?
It says that up to a certain point, you can keep offering more money, but it's not going to make a difference in whether people make a decision to call in. I think what's most important is to protect the confidentiality of the caller.
Right.
Because people are afraid of retaliation. That's the primary reason why people don't report crimes in the first place. They're afraid of retaliation, or in the United States, they have a poor relationship with the police. They don't trust the police. So what I'm hearing and what I like about The program that you're talking about is that it has the potential to bring citizens in a better relationship with the police, to give citizens a feeling of efficacy that they're making their neighborhoods and communities safer. That's a very good thing. That could have effects that ramify beyond the program itself if it improves the relationship between residents and law enforcement. And also giving people a sense of empowerment in making the neighborhood safer. As a psychologist, I would say that in itself is extremely beneficial. And if it's going to operate like Crime Stoppers, that means it's going to get into the public's ears and eyes more information about law enforcement working hard to make neighborhoods safer and going after people that have harmed others. I'm a victim advocate. And victims of crime can suffer lifelong symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if it's a violent crime. And you're talking about the dangerous criminals really hurting people, and the hurt doesn't go away.
But let me interject. You know, when we talk about amounts, saying there's a certain point where the amount doesn't matter. But if it's too low, that would not prompt somebody to assume the risk to call in, would it?
That's an excellent observation. But if there can be an analysis of the data that shows there's an amount too high, because you have limited resources, you have a pot of money, you should spend what you need to spend to have people call in.
Well, what do you think? Where is that sweet spot? Is $100,000 too much?
No, we were working on a case by case basis. For example, people would be as likely to call in if we gave them $100 as opposed to $250. People would be as likely to call in if we offered $500 as we offered $250. That didn't make a difference. So it's really a matter of gauging how much money you have in your total pot. What do you need to spend efficiently and effectively to get people to call in, which is an empirical question. I think and my colleagues and I have been the only professors who've ever investigated the question. I don't believe it's been investigated previously. I like very much your point about maybe there's a calibration. Maybe you're paid more money if the case is it goes to the coldest end of the continuum, which means the length of time it hasn't been solved. And maybe you go to the higher end if it's somebody who's particularly dangerous, who has wreaked havoc on communities, who's committed homicide.
Now, Arthur,
serious violent crimes.
How are the rewards then determined? I mean, by what criteria? Is it just an anonymous tip that leads to the apprehension of the individual? Does the individual have to be processed through the court system? I mean, and by the way, if you've got, say, conflicting people who have called in or competing claims as to where individual may be, what is, say, the criterion by which the reward will be given? There's a determination this person deserves it.
Excellent question. And it varied by program. And at one point, I think there were over 900 Crime Stoppers programs in the United States. So the determination would be made based on law enforcement input, the board of directors input, the media's input. It was a decision that was made as a consensual one. This is what I would recommend. If you reach the threshold for arrest, I think they should pay people for that. Many programs, however, said, no, not arrest alone, but arrest and prosecution. So that's a higher standard to prosecute. Other programs said you'll get paid when there's a conviction. Now, if it's a serious crime, if it's a felony, it's going to take years to wind its way through the system. So I think to get people engaged and excited to be involved in this program overall, there might be some consideration being given to arrest. And maybe the reward is less for arrest. And then maybe the reward is greater for prosecution because the standard of proof goes up from arrest to prosecution. And then it goes to the highest level for a conviction. The only problem with the conviction is many years away from the call.
And right. But graduated rewards. And so when somebody calls in anonymously, how are they tabulated so that the reward can get to them if there's supposedly this veil of anonymity that doesn't involve the police per se?
Yes. They would assign them a number.
Ah, okay.
And they would meet them and I would ride around with the police. They would meet with them in a secluded place in the community after midnight and pay them to protect their anonymity and their safety.
Yeah, it's surreptitious at the end, but I guess that's the only way it can be done. That's very, very informative. Arthur, I appreciate your time and thank you for clarifying that on a day where our police announced the BOLO, be on the lookout for these criminals rewards program. Thank you so much.
I wish the program great success, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
Duly noted. Again, best to you. Arthur Lorigio, criminologist with Loyola University in Chicago. How truthful is Joe Biden? I mean, there's a litany of stories surrounding the president of the United States and nose stretchers. I mean, I've got to talk about some of these nose stretchers. In a moment, we'll do that. More Oakley, 640 Toronto.
There's nothing that strikes fear in the hearts of politicians more than John Oakley.
All right, well, we were talking about veracity, truth, and its opposite, its evil twin, lies. And what is it the man said? There are lies, damn lies, and statistics. Statistically, Joe Biden, I guess, is apt to lie about once every 2 or 3 days. Let's not even bring Trump into this. He's actually facing the music in a court of law.
I will not speak the truth.
Okay, in a court of public opinion, though. I mean, it's become somewhat comical. We've had fun just compiling a list of Biden's nose stretchers.
Yeah, there's embellishing, and then there's Biden.
Well, the latest now is the leader in Papua New Guinea is really upset because Biden's cast his country into a negative light, saying, you know, we don't actually have cannibals here, and nor did we have them back in World War II when Uncle Bozy... this was Ambrose Fitzcannon or whatever his name was. This was Joe Biden's uncle, long lost uncle at sea in the theater of war down there, Solomon Islands and New Guinea during, you know, World War II. But his plane ditched into the ocean and it said that only one person survived, swam to shore. Otherwise, the other two went down with the plane. Biden, his account, that he's doubled down on, by the way, he told once and then he reiterated again last week, was that the plane went down in the jungle and they never found Bozy because he was eaten by cannibals.
He went down in the water jungle, the ocean.
You know, I mean, where does it stop with this guy? I mean, is it enough to discredit him? Is this really the linchpin that would say, you know, he's not really fit for office because he can't tell the truth or he can't maintain, you know, a consistent story?
I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
Well, you know, when he said he had helped free Nelson Mandela off Robben Island. No, I mean, he was nowhere near Robben Island. And so this is going back to, I guess, the 80s and 1988, I guess, or thereabouts. Yeah. So what else do we say? I mean, Biden falsely claimed that he was at ground zero the day after the Twin Towers fell in Manhattan. We never forget is what he said. Each of us, each of those precious lives stolen too soon when evil attacked. Ground Zero in New York, I remember standing there the next day and looking at the building and I felt like I was looking through the gates of hell. It looked so devastating because of the way from where you could stand. He wasn't there. Anyway, you know, people have put him, fixed him in another place based on the timeline. You know, as the senator that he was from Delaware at the time.
Man who can never remember anything says, we can never forget.
Yeah. Okay. I love this. During the Obama-Biden administration, he says 18,000 people got clemency. In other words, were forgiven their crimes and became free men. Obama issued 1,927 pardons and commutations, during his 2 terms. Not 18,000, 1,900. So what's a decimal point, right? What's an extra zero?
Oh.
What, but, you know, this is the kind of stuff when he says it. The fact checkers are all over Trump. And, you know, Daniel Dale, who used to work here at the Star, you know, he's now down there toiling for CNN as the resident fact checker. But it's only one-sided. It's all on Trump.
Well, he's doing some fact checking on Biden, but you'll notice if you ever see him, he never calls Biden a liar. But he can't stop calling Trump a liar.
Right.
He positions Biden as, well, as of yet, this is we don't believe this to be true. Like, if any, like, well, oh, you know what? We found the cannibals that ate your uncle. Like, it's going to become true.
Right. Yeah, there were a bunch of these old guys burping in the jungle.
Yeah, we found a bunch of sea cannibal mermaid creatures that ate Brosie.
Brosie. Uncle Brosie. I love that. He's made it sound so colloquial and familiar. Uncle Brosie was eaten by cannibals there. Anyway, listen.
What a folksy tale.
We got to find some of those clips because out of his own words and his mouth, you'll get the sense for this guy. He believes his own crap, which, you know, the good liar does. They can say it so convincingly. In fact, you know, there was a comic, Lenny Bruce, years ago, who used to talk about somebody specifically that was given to lying. And while other people would get busted for it, there were some who just saw the guy as an artist of sorts. We know you're full of crap, but you just do it so well. Get over here and spin some yarns. And then John Lovitz on SNL way back about 30 years ago, I guess, he used to do The Liar, remember? That he was dating... anyway, some Hollywood starlet. I mean, it was just, yeah, that's the ticket. We all remember that one. Joe Biden, though, after he became vice president, he says at the behest of his father, he gave his uncle Frank H. Biden a Purple Heart for serving in the U.S. military during World War II. He served at the Battle of the Bulge. The event could not have happened as President Joe Biden described. Obituaries for the president's uncle show he died in 1999, almost a decade before Biden became vice president, and Biden's father died in 2002. It just, the timeline doesn't square.
Who'd he give the Purple Heart to?
You know, it was really at his home. This is the way Biden tells it. He recounts that he brought the Purple Heart home, and his father says, now would be a good time to give it to Uncle Frank. And so Uncle Frank was already in the crypt by about 12 years.
Joe's wandering around the living room talking to himself. He just awarded a Purple Heart to the coat rack.
Right. Well, you know, recently, too, remember he claimed he saw that bridge collapse? Well, one in Pittsburgh, he said he saw a bridge collapse in Pittsburgh, even though it collapsed hours before he arrived. And there was the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore that he claimed that he was familiar with because he had taken the train over it out of Delaware to Washington several times.
Mm.
Trouble is, there were no train tracks on that bridge.
No.
Well, I mean, but this is beautiful, beautiful stuff. When we hear these kinds of no-stretchers, they're so grandiose. You kind of say, hey, you know, Joe, tell that story again. I'd rather hear the story and, you know, how he's embellished it and so on and so forth. By the way, he says he's been to Afghanistan, Iraq, and those areas twice as president. Joe Biden has not visited Afghanistan or Iraq while president. Fact checkers looked it up. So what do we make of this, you know? Do you call BS on somebody? Maybe you've got somebody in your own life, a work colleague or whatever, and you know they're full of crap. Do you call BS or do you just say, well, you know, that's Jim?
Well, it depends. Are they an elderly and well-meaning gentleman? Just let it go.
I remember was Eric Tunney, the comic, actually had, you know, his grandfather who was given to lying about his exploits in World War II. Say, like, come on, granddad, fist fight with Hitler. You know, so you can't really trust the memory of, say, some of the elderly, and Joe Biden would qualify. Here's another one. As a youth, I got arrested protesting for civil rights. There's no evidence that Biden was actually arrested in either the legal sense or in how ordinary listeners would be likely to understand that term. At times, Biden himself has described the police's actions as driving him home rather than putting him under arrest.
Right. We found this man wandering. Does he belong to you?
Right. He was in the police car, ergo, he thought he was under arrest. They're just giving the doddering old fool a drive home. He said he used to drive a tractor trailer, only did it for part of a summer. As a senator, Joe Biden rode along on a truck drive from Delaware to Ohio. Anyway, he had a summer job as a bus driver while in law school, so that's almost there. What was the other grandiose one that he told about beating guy up corn pop? You know, some tough guy in his neighborhood took a bicycle chain to him. Anyway, so he's going to take him out back and straighten him out, and Corn Pop didn't bother anybody ever again. There's no real evidence that a guy named Corn Pop ever existed.
I love this. The Biden should write some kind of history book, Yarns and Musings with Uncle Joe.
Hmm.
Beer brewed here, it is used to make the brew beer in this fine. Oh, Earth Rider, thanks for the Great Lakes.
That's the middle of the day at a brewery in Wisconsin.
Oh, Lord, America's in trouble. I mean, seriously, you've got two choices, and I can hardly wait to see how this one plays out in the next 6 months. It is going to be a clown show. At a town hall meeting, a home care provider spoke to former Vice President Joe Biden about racist rhetoric targeting Asian Americans during the pandemic. Biden responded by leaning into racism allegations against Donald Trump. We've had racists, and they've existed. They've tried to get elected president. He's the first one that has, Biden said. Biden also backed Robert Byrd, who was, I think, a grand wizard in the Klan. And then when he tried to rehabilitate his image, he became a senator.
Wow.
That's a matter of record. Historians agree that many presidents in the past either had racist beliefs, implemented racist policies, or both. So Trump wasn't the first, but Biden, of course. You know, and when you've got sort of a preset acceptance of a narrative, a lot of people don't question this.
You know, on the issue of racism, which president was it who told Charlemagne the Ruler?
The God.
Charlemagne the God, that's it. If you vote for Trump, you ain't black.
That's right. That was Biden.
That was Biden. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You ain't black. Anyway, listen, nothing happened. I mean, the guy became president anyway.
Listen to the John Oakley Show live each weekday afternoon from 3 until 6. If you live in the Toronto area, just turn that AM dial to 640 and listen anywhere on Earth 24 hours a day by going to 640toronto.com. Follow on Twitter at @AM640Oakley. You've been listening to A Curious Cast. New podcasts and shows are debuting all the time. So check back often to see what's new in the Curious Cast library.